Well, last week we finished up Joshua chapter 2, and this week we're going to start in chapter 3. Last week we saw Israel was camping about 7 miles east of the Jordan River, and they sent 2 spies to Jericho, which is about 7 miles west of the Jordan River, and they sent those spies in secretly. They were there to check out land, obstacles, people. Joshua wanted to know what they would be facing. And they went to the house of Rahab the harlot, found out that their secret mission wasn't much of a secret. The king of Jericho sent word to Rahab. We know that they're there. We know they're spies. We know they're from the Israelites. Bring these men out. Rahab's response was, well, I didn't know they were spies. And they left before the gate was closed for the city. And they were headed east to the river. If you hurry, you might catch them. And in actuality, she had hidden the spies upstairs in a room where she had drying flax that they were hidden back in. And so the king sent his men out to catch them on the road to the river. Right after the men went out, the town gate was shut. And Rahab went up to talk to these men on the roof. And she gave a bit of a testimony. I know Yahweh has given you the land. She said, we're all in terror. We know how you crossed the Red Sea, how God gave you victory over the Amorites east of the Jordan. And Yahweh is great in heaven and on the earth. And so please swear to me by Yahweh to deal kindly with my father's household. And there were a numbers of back and forth, but an agreement was made. You spare our lives, we will spare yours, provided you don't reveal our business here. She was to put a scarlet cord out the window to mark her house. Her house was built in and on the city wall. And they said, all of your father's household must be in the house. If they're outside, that's their risk. And whatever happens, happens then. But we will be free from this agreement with you to spare your family when we come to the city, if you tell. And so all of this is agreed to. She lets them out of her window by a rope, and she instructs them, advises them to go to the east and spend 3 days, go west and spend 3 days in the hills to the west. And then after the pursuers are back in the city and back in the camp, should be about 3 days, then you can go ahead and go back to the east and go back to your own camp. And they did, and they told Joshua everything. And we also spent some time then noticing Rahab's role in the lineage of Jesus and throughout history. And Jesus clearly was planned as Savior before the foundation of the world. And so that had to have been known to God. And we get a chance to back up a step and see how God unfolded his great plans for his coming son Jesus. And that actually is through the house of David on the way. So she's also in David's lineage. And we took a few minutes to think about that. Any questions or comments over what we talked about last time? Okay, well, let's go ahead and get into chapter 3 and see what time it is when we get through with that. We might make ourselves over into 4 a little bit. We'll see how that goes. So let me read verses 1 through 17, which is the whole chapter of chapter 3. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and he and all the sons of Israel set out from Shittim and came to the Jordan. And they lodged there before they crossed. At the end of 3 days, the officers went through the midst of the camp. And they commanded the people, saying, when you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, with the Levitical priests carrying it, then you shall set out from your place and go after it. However, there shall be between you and it a distance of about 2,000 cubits by measure. Do not come near it, that you may know the way by which you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. Then Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. And Joshua spoke to the priests, saying, take up the Ark of the Covenant and cross over ahead of the people. So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went ahead of the people. Now the Lord said to Joshua, this day I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. You shall, moreover, command the priests who are carrying the Ark of the Covenant, saying, when you come to the edge of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. Then Joshua said to the sons of Israel, come here and hear the words of the Lord your God. Joshua said, by this you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will assuredly dispossess from before you the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Hivite, the Perizzite, the Girgashite, the Amorite, and the Jebusite. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is crossing over ahead of you into the Jordan. Now then, take for yourselves 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one man for each tribe. It shall come about when the soles of the feet of the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan will be cut off, and the waters which are flowing down from above will stand in one heap. So when the people set out from their tents to cross the Jordan with the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and when those who carried the Ark came into the Jordan, and the feet of the priests carrying the Ark were dipped in the edge of the water, for the Jordan overflows all its banks all the days of harvest, the waters which were flowing down from above stood and rose up in one heap, a great distance away, at Adam, the city that is beside Zarethan, and those which were flowing down toward the sea of the Arabah, the salt sea, were completely cut off. So the people crossed opposite Jericho, and the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan, while all Israel crossed on dry ground until all the nation had finished crossing the Jordan. It's a fairly straightforward account of what happened, but let's stop and look at the details as we go through it. So after the spies return the next day, everyone's up early, and they move their camp to be just east of the Jordan. And so they're there camping on the east bank. I move their camp west of the Jordan, on the east bank of the river. And they had been in the camp 3 days when the officers of the people spread word themselves, saying, when you see the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh, God Almighty, carried by the priests, then set out and follow it, but keep a distance. And the distance was to be 2,000 cubits, which is about 1,000 yards. So as I hear yards and cubits, yards not as bad as cubits, but when I start thinking about 1,000 yards, I have a little trouble visualizing that. I don't know why. I've always had trouble visualizing 1,000 yards, but 10 football fields. So you can just, in your mind's eye, picture the space that there to be behind the Ark as it comes through and the priests that are carrying it. And Joshua says to the people, consecrate yourselves. Tomorrow Yahweh will do wonders for you. So what did Joshua ask them to do when he said, consecrate yourselves? If somebody said to you, consecrate yourself, tomorrow we're going to have a big worship service, what would you do? What does that mean? What's that?
Clean.
Make yourself clean? Okay.
Set apart.
Yeah, so, I'm glad you said it that way. The word is kadesh, which I'm not even going to begin to try to tell you what that, or show you what that looks like in Hebrew letters. But most of the time, it is actually translated sanctify. And sanctify clearly has within it being set apart. But there's more to sanctification than just being set apart. Because sanctification also means you're not just set apart for a task or a position or whatever, a place in God's kingdom, but also sanctification includes being made fully ready. It's not just external. It's not just designation. It also includes growth and clarity and holiness, personal holiness, casting aside those things that are fleshly and worldly so that you can be devoted to the function for which you have been set apart. And so be set apart for holy use, for pure use, or be holy. And Joshua says, why? Yahweh tomorrow is going to do many wonders among you. The presence of God is going to be there, and his great power is going to be on display. What kind of reaction internally do you think you would have if all of a sudden you were in a situation where God made it clear he was there and was doing miraculous things right in front of your eyes? When you've got a glimpse of the idea of the majesty of who God is, and you're seeing him at work, and he's at work on the behalf of holiness, how are you going to feel?
In awe.
In awe? Yes, fearful. We have so many accounts of people like Ezekiel that come into a situation where he is seeing the magnificence of God right before him, and he's like, oh, woe is me. You don't measure up. One of the best illustrations that I heard about that a little bit in modern times is somewhat of a negative one with regard to the reality of what was going on at the time. And I don't want to go into the organization or the people involved, but there was an individual that claimed to be specially called by God to lead a pretty big movement, one you've heard of, but I'm not going to worry about that. And he said that God appeared to him while he was shaving. And while he's shaving, God presented to him a purple guitar, because God had called Elvis and gave him all of that ability, but Elvis kind of failed God in the role that he wanted him to be, so now he was going to be like the one to take over Elvis's role and do it in a holy way. And the person that was talking about this was saying negatively, this is silly. What did the person do? He kept on shaving. He said, no, that isn't how it's going to work. If God showed up in your mirror while you're shaving, you're not going to keep on shaving. And that's kind of a negative illustration, but they're going to be face to face with the living God. At least in terms of his actions, it's going to be right in front of them. And he's saying, tomorrow's the day you're going to be in the presence of God at work. Get ready. Sanctify yourself so that while that is occurring, you may continue to be a part of it without just woe is me and falling down all over yourself. And have these very people, before been in the presence of God?
Maybe
if they were young enough. But remember the holy mountain? God descended and you could hear him, and he was loud and he was clear, and the people wanted what to happen? What was their reaction when at least the ancestors of these people came face to face with God on Mount Sinai?
Hide.
What's that? What did you say, Rick?
They were afraid.
They were afraid. You said they wanted to hide. What was their specific request?
Moses,
you do it. We don't want to do this. We're out of this. You go find out what he wants, and then you come tell us what he wants, and we'll do it. Not really, but they said they would. And they, of course, didn't. But these people haven't had as much experience. Now, they've had some experiences. What experiences have they been a part of?
Across the Red Sea?
Well, maybe if they were really young.
Oh, okay.
What's that?
The battles fighting Shion and all
Okay, the battles with the Amorites. There's one they had daily yet.
Manna.
They were still getting manna out of heaven. And as they wandered, they weren't style conscious. Because the styles didn't change, did they? Their clothes didn't wear out. They wore the same clothes from beginning to end. And what we're used to in the way that clothes wear wasn't reality for them. They were able to maintain their clothing and continue, and were actually led by God throughout the time of their 40 years of wandering. So they have seen some of God's work, but Joshua is saying it's going to be an intimidating situation tomorrow if you're not ready for it. And then as we go on, Joshua says, the priests are going to come. They're going to take the Ark of the Covenant. They're going to cross over ahead of you. And what's significant about the Ark of the Covenant? And I'm cheating you a little bit by not using all the words in the text as I recount this. The Ark of the Covenant was the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh. So what's significant about this Ark as it's moving in front of them?
It's the Lord's seat.
It's the Lord's seat. It is, when I think of the Ark of the Covenant, the first things that come to my mind are the things that are in it and the covenant itself. And it isn't called the covenant, the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh and Abraham, is it? It's called the covenant of Yahweh because God said, I'm making this covenant with you. It was God's covenant. Abraham, at the time the covenant was given, was not the key player. He was not an equal player. So many times covenants, they're equal players. This person has dominion over this. This person has dominion over that. And they agree that in the things that they have dominion over, this is what they're going to do. But Abraham's dominion was non-existent for all practical purposes, except over himself. And so God made this covenant with Abraham because he chose Abraham. But also, if you think about this, where is the covenant kept when they're not traveling? In the Holy of Holies. And what's on the Ark of the Covenant? The mercy seat. And it's at the place of God's dwelling is the mercy seat. And so annually they're in there sprinkling blood from sacrifices to find forgiveness of their sins at the mercy seat. It's at the mercy seat that God declared, this will be my place to talk to you. So they're bringing God out of the Holy of Holies to his mercy seat and the Ark of the Covenant that holds it, the very seat that God would reside upon, if you can say it that way, is in before them as they're headed off into the Jordan for the purpose of receiving from God. And that's key. They weren't there to be a mighty army and to capture it out of their strength. They were there to receive from God his dispossessing of the land from the people that were already there. That's the way God put it. And so here is this ark going before them. And the promise to Abraham included that they would be a great nation and that that nation would exist in the promised land. And so here they are seeing the very beginning moments of the birth of those promises being truly fulfilled. And then Yahweh said to Joshua, I'm going to exalt you this day. This will be the beginning of it. It's going to be done in the sight of all Israel. And then the Israel will know that I am with you in like manner of the way that I was with Moses. And so this is a very interesting thing that he says. God says, tell the priests, command the priests, carrying the Ark of the Covenant, when you come to the edge of the waters of the river, stand still in the Jordan. And so Joshua gathers the people together and says, Hear the words of Yahweh God Almighty, your God. He says, when you see this, you will know the living God is among you. Right before you. Behold, he says, he will surely take away the possessions, and depossess is the right word, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Hivite, the Perizzite, the Girgazite, and the Amorite, and the Jebusite. This is going to happen. God's going to take it away from them, implying, and give it to you. And so right before you, the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh, the God of all the earth, is crossing over ahead of you into the Jordan. And before we go on, I want you to just take a second and look at that handout I left back there for you. Unashamedly taken from the John MacArthur Study Bible. However, if there are errors, you have to blame me for it because I retyped it to make it fit on this page well. And I went through it multiple times to see if I could get all the proofreading done right. And you already know I'm a terrible proofreader. I did find some hilarious mistakes. But I got the hilarious ones out as far as I know. But it's interesting to look at all of the different people groups that were in the area or in the promised land. And there are four of them that I want to highlight that I just, when I see it, I go, wow. It's hard for me to relate to what it was to be in the offspring of Abraham in this era when I think about these things. Look first at the Amalekites. Now, the Amalekites are people that God has a real problem with. If you remember, he vowed to wipe them out. Well, who were they? They were the descendants of Amalek. Well, who was Amalek? Esau's grandson. You're a descendant of Jacob if you're a Jew. Esau is Jacob's brother, and they're descendants of a grandchild of Esau. You're out there looking people who are very distant at this point probably, but you're looking at your cousins that God's going to take some of this land away from. The Amorites, they were the grandson of Lot, by his youngest daughter. Who was Lot? Abraham's nephew. More distant cousins. If you skip on down to the Edomites, they're the descendants of Esau, who settled southeast of the Palestine. And so, Esau, once again, the heir that you point to, we're Jacobites, we're Israelites. That's his brother. And then go down to the Moabites. Remember Moab and all the things that happened with the intrigue of Balaam and all of that? They were the grandson of Lot. You're out here with your relatives in many cases, distant relatives. But it's kind of like, where did the family heritage get so goofed up? And yet, of course, if you go back and look at World War I, most of those national leaders were kings that were related to each other. Look at the Russians and the Germans and the British. They all were from one family, pretty much, that were leading those countries. But here they were, and here's the people in the area. Some of these were a little bit on the edge, but it would be part of their encounter to get there. And I just found that interesting enough, I thought I would bring that to you. It's not of particular importance, but it it reminds us of where we are in the history. We're not that far from a ship with Noah and his family on it. As a matter of fact, the Canaanites themselves are descendants of Ham. His son was Canaan, and the Canaanites were cursed because of the way Ham mistreated, disrespected his father sometime after they made it back to ground, and he behaved in a terrible way, and a curse was pronounced on Canaan as a result of that. And so it's an interesting cultural time being that close to Noah's Ark and being also seeing that a number of these folks came out of the family of Abraham. And so, continue on. And some instructions for the people start out in verse 12. He says, take for yourselves, you pick them. In other words, I'm not going to go pick them, you pick them, people. 12 men, one from each tribe. And when the soles of the feet of the priests carrying the ark of Yahweh of the Lord of all the earth rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters will be cut off. The water flowing from above will stand in one heap. And so we can picture the scene a bit. The people are setting out in verse 14 from their tents, from the camp. And they're going to cross the Jordan. They come up. The ark is passed ahead of them. They're following at a distance. Earlier in the chapter, it was said, you need to follow at a distance so you'll know the way. You haven't been here before. And if you think about that a minute, there are very few people who have been there before of this group. It would be limited to what? Two spies? You know, that went out. And so here they are. They came to the Jordan. And when the feet of the priests of the ark are dipped in the edge of the water, he says, the flooding Jordan will stop. The water's flowing downstream, it sounds like, will get away, but those upstream are going to rise up in one heap. We're going to talk more about that flooding Jordan in a little bit. And so when it happens, that did heap up, and it was at Adam near Zarethan. And the best we can determine is that Adam was 15 miles to the north of where they would be crossing. So that's quite a ways. But the water flowing to the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea to the south is going to just go on by. And so he tells them this happens, and the priest then will, and then the people will cross. And the priests carried the Ark of the Covenant. They went to the center of the Jordan. And when they were in the center of the Jordan, what was their situation? What does it say about the conditions that they were in when they're standing in the center of the Jordan while the people are crossing? Dry, firm, dry ground. Has anybody in here ever been somewhere there's been water for a while? Whether it's in a river or whatever, and then tried to walk out where it has kind of receded down. You ever walked on that? Well, Kansas is different than Israel. And if this was a rocky enough river, maybe that isn't as big of a deal as it seems to me that it is. But I have been places where the first step, you went up to your knee in mud. Now, I don't know what it was like there. I'm not trying to say that's what it was. But the fact it was dry, when moments ago there was a river flowing, we know this was a miracle. And they were standing there on firm, dry ground while all of Israel crossed over. Now, we've got a few things about this that we need to talk about. I'm going to kind of do it backwards. All Israel crossed over. How many was that? Anybody want to try some guesses? I don't have an absolutely correct answer, but I've got some logic I can put behind it. Millions. Okay, that's a pretty good place to start. In Numbers chapter 26, in terms of the non-Levitical tribe, they counted the men 20 and older that would be capable of being soldiers. And they came to 607,730 men. Then they added the Levites. They're not going to be soldiers, but they counted them differently. If they were, I says down here, a month old and older, and that's probably right. I had in my brain 6 months, but one of those two. But they counted the Levites, males, that were toddlers and older, or maybe newborns almost and older, and that came to 23,000. So if you add those two together, that's 630,730 men. Okay? Now, when the people that try to figure out intelligent guesses to these kinds of things looked at So how many Israelites were there, which we weren't, it was never recorded in Scripture? They say, well, probably about 2 million or a little more. I think that's really small, and I'll tell you why I think that's small. Because that means you're adding roughly 14,000. That's just a little over two additional persons per male. Doesn't sound big enough, does it? Okay, now let's talk about the crossing here. Did the whole nation cross over? Okay, we got the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh. And that was 40,000 fighting men. So that 40,000 went, but the families, the children, the wives, the non-fighting men, they would have stayed east of the Jordan. So you're going to knock that down a little bit. It's still going to seem like an awful lot of people if you're standing out there holding that ark. And one thing we don't know is how broad was the crossing. If it's dry ground, 15 miles, where they were plus 15 miles north, I'm guessing that crossing, that crossing might have got pretty broad. I don't know. I doubt if it was single file. And so somewhere in there were a lot of people that had to cross in this day. And so they did. Certainly well more than a million. A lot of people moving. So how long would it take? I don't know. I don't have even a good logic to guess that one out. I do know there are some stadiums around here that hold lots of people that empty out in an hour. So it might not have been, you know, hard to do that in the daylight that was provided that day. Could there have been a miraculous aspect to this crossing that more people crossed than you would have expected to be able in that period of time? Certainly. If we're gonna have the water heap up 15 miles north of where you're at, everything is open to what God might choose to do. And the way the text reads, and this is just the way I take it when I read it, that water piling up 15 miles to the north is still flowing and continuing to pile up while they do this. Now, I don't know that that's accurate, but I don't think the water stopped flowing. Maybe it did, but it doesn't say that it did. And so here they are doing this unnatural thing, crossing where a moment ago there was a flooded river on what could have been soft and muddy ground, but they were on firm, dry ground. So when did they cross? And really, we can get this down pretty accurately. In this chapter, we see it was the time of harvest, and it says that it always floods at the time of the harvest. So you can start guessing around, but we don't have to, because in chapter 4, we get another clue, but we get something very exact before we're done. They're going to celebrate the Passover just after they cross the river. Now, there's some other activities that happen. So they're near the time of the Passover, the 14th day of the first month. But if we keep reading, in the next chapter, I believe it is, chapter 4, verse 19, we're not going to go read it. But it tells us exactly when they crossed, on the 10th of the first month. That's the month of Nisan, which was then just, in terms of comparing it to when they left Egypt, just a few days in terms of annual anniversaries. The anniversary for leaving Egypt would have been just a few days after their crossing here. And so that's when they're at. In the course of trying to understand this well, I was hearing this time of harvest, and to me, I tend to think of the fall as a time of harvest. But they had multiple feasts and harvests that went with it, so I just went out, and this is in modern times, and looked up, when do they get their moisture in Israel? And the rainy season begins in November and ends in April. It's a pretty long rainy season, but by the end of that time then, it's flooding. Part of the Passover is that's very near the time of one of the harvests. The barley harvest is usually going on about the time of the Passover. So That gives us some information about when is this occurring and what's going on and why is it that way. What is this miracle reminiscent of in the time of the Exodus?
Crossing the Red Sea.
Yeah, crossing the Red Sea. I mean, there's a lot of obvious things. What are some of the similarities?
Ground's
dry. Crossed on dry ground.
The water heaped up,
but there is a difference, but we'll talk about that in a minute. The water heaped up. What else? God leading. Yeah, they didn't have the ark yet, but it was commanded by God. And both times, he basically says, you're going in through the water, and God arranges, what's that?
He led in the cloud.
Yeah. And God arranges the parting of that water. Yeah, that's the most of the things. What are some differences? At what moment does the sea part in the time of crossing the Red Sea? Now, you could say at the command of God, but God commands something. What does he command? Nope. Moses, spread... Put your staff out over the water, and it separates. And apparently he didn't have to hold it the whole time, because when he gets back on the other side and here comes the Egyptians, God's kind of tapping Moses on the shoulder. Hey, hold your staff up again. Watch this. And so all the Egyptian army is drowned as he puts his staff back out in the water to come together. What's some other differences? Yeah, that's a big deal in a lot of ways. The people that crossed the Red Sea were in despair and kind of hard to work with. What were they saying to Moses? Weren't there enough graves over in Egypt that we had to come out here to die? You know, they kind of have an attitude that you don't see here. What's another difference?
The water's parted versus being heaped up.
Yes, and part of that is... somewhat potentially at least related to the fact that the Jordan is a flowing water and the Red Sea was not. One other one that I've got down, that's all I've got, is that the water was heaped up far away. It talks about in the crossing of the Red Sea, seeing those walls of water. That would be intimidating. If they crossed where we think they cross, they were probably looking at 1,000 foot plus tall water of water. I might have that wrong. It might be 600 foot tall. I'd have to go back and look. I'm doing that from memory. But it's a tall chunk of water. You can't see over the top of it. That, to me, when there's nothing physical you can see holding it back, that would be an experience that you wouldn't soon forget. Okay? And so those are some of the things that are going on as this crossing occurs. Okay? So now we're across the Jordan. We're now on the west bank. I think there's some significance of that we're going to see in the next chapter. Any questions or comments about 13? Chapter 3? We're a long ways from 13. Yes. It is interesting. It's somewhat the fruit of Lot's exposure to that decadent situation in Sodom. And those women were concerned that they would not have offspring to see to them later in their life. And so they took advantage of their father's drunkenness at one point. Yep, that is interesting.
So, in those people groups, do we have any connection to where they are today as far as their ancestors?
I didn't attempt that. I'm sure that if we went to the right places, we could find people that did have some of those connections. I will say this, an interesting people group to talk about today are the ones that are inhabiting Gaza and claim a certain relationship historically with the place. And it's tempting at times to connect them with the Philistines, and there may be a little bit of that, but when you start trying to back that up and look at it, the historical people that I have read and looked at don't wind up with a people group connected with that place. But beyond that, I really don't have much information in my head about those things. Yes?
Rick, weren't a lot of these people, I'm just thinking because the women's Bible study is a little further on in the chapter in Joshua, weren't a lot of these people completely wiped out?
Yes. Okay. Now, this is at the start of the conquest.
Yeah, and so I was regarding that.
Well, yeah, the Amalekites would be high on that list. But it's interesting, it takes until the time of Solomon to get them wiped out. So, yes, some of those people groups were gone. Yes, sir?
Well, Ruth was a Moabite.
Yep.
There would be Jewish people alive today.
Ruth, yeah.
There would be Jewish people alive today, descendants of David.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we just got through studying another clear example. Rahab was not a Jew. She was probably a Canaanite. You could say that she was a Jerichoite. I don't know if I just made up the wrong word or not. But so there are multiple instances of non-Jews being involved in the Jewish bloodline. I mean, it's a little bit... I don't know if this is fair, but I'm going to say it. It's a little bit like looking at our bloodlines in this country. I mean, there are marriages and connections and children born that are not, I mean, racial purity is not a real thing. It does get, I don't know what the right word is, but it doesn't stay pure, and I don't mean pure in a spiritual way. I mean pure in a bloodlines way. And the only time that we see any people given that I know of, somebody might show me somewhere I'm wrong, and that would be fine. But the Jews were the one God looked at and said, "Don't be intermarried." But his reason wasn't about bloodlines. What was his reason? Do you remember? We've already seen it. You're going to get corrupted. You marry a woman or a man from outside our people, and they're going to take you to their gods, and you're going to be worshiping these idols. And so it was a spiritual end that he was looking at to limit the corruption of the people. We're the Yahweh-following people, and we want to stay that way. So you're only going to marry within people that are truly Yahweh following. Does that make sense? Okay?
So, Rick, I have a crazy question.
Okay.
It's just me thinking, but, you know, you said some of the people were wiped out. So is there more people at the time that they crossed the Red Sea than there was when they crossed the Jordan?
Well, I'll say it this way.
Okay.
There were more people in Canaan, the land of Canaan. Well, I don't know if that's true or not. I'll tell you what I'm going to say, and then I'm going to tell you why it might be false. There were more people. Well, you'll see why I said it that way in a minute. There are more people. There are a lot of non-Jewish people alive in Canaan, and when they get done with the conquest, there's a lot less of them. Okay. Now, this is why it might be false. Was the Jewish nation bigger or smaller than the number of people that were dispossessed from the land? I don't know. I don't know how many total people God, in his sovereign holiness, said, "I'm wiping them out." And I don't know how that compares to the number of Jews that came in to replace them. So that would be the only way to answer the question, is to know the total number of people whose lives were taken in the conquest. Good question. Interesting question. Anything else? All right, let's take a look at chapter 4 because there's really not a real much of a break here. And I've got down to read the first 18 verses, and I'm going to read them, but I don't know if we'll get them all discussed. So chapter 4 and the first 18 verses. Now when all the nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, "Take for yourselves 12 men from the people, one man from each tribe, and command them, saying, 'Take up for yourselves 12 stones from here out of the middle of the Jordan, from the place where the priest's feet are standing firm, and carry them over with you, and lay them down in the lodging place where you will lodge tonight.' So Joshua called the 12 men whom he had appointed from the sons of Israel, one from each tribe. And Joshua said to them, 'Cross again to the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan, and each of you take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Israel. Let this be a sign among you, so that when your children ask later, saying, "What do these stones mean to you?" then you shall say to them, "Because the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord, when it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall become a memorial to the sons of Israel forever." Thus the sons of Joshua did as Joshua commanded, and took up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, just as the Lord spoke to Joshua, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Israel. And they carried them over with them to the lodging place and put them down there. Then Joshua set up 12 stones in the middle of the Jordan at the place where the feet of the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant were standing, and they are there to this day. For the priests who carried the Ark were standing in the middle of the Jordan until everything was completed that the Lord had commanded Joshua to speak to the people, according to all that Moses had commanded him, commanded Joshua. And the people hurried and crossed. And when all the people had finished crossing, the ark of the Lord and the priests crossed before the people. I'm going to stop there. And we're going to look at these 11 verses. So after everybody's over, Yahweh talks to Joshua and says, appoint 12 men, one for each tribe. And here's what you're to do. Order them to gather 12 stones from the Jordan, from the middle, by the priest's feet, and carry them to the west bank by where we camp tonight. And so this is the message for Joshua. Now there's a difference here between these 12 men and the 12 men earlier. Because the 12 men earlier, Joshua said, pick from among yourselves 12 men. They're to lead as they go across the Jordan River. But here, Joshua is picking 12 men, one from each tribe, and giving them direct orders. Go over, get 12 stones from where the priests are standing, and bring them out. So they go back to get those. And Joshua, when he gives them the order, says, also carry the stone on your shoulder. What does this tell you about the stones? They didn't carry some pebbles on their shoulders. They were carrying big stones on their shoulders. And he said, this will be for a sign. When the children ask about the stones, then you can tell what happened in detail. You can tell about the waters of the Jordan being cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh. And I like the way he says that. He doesn't just say, so you can tell them that it happened. No, you tell them that it happened and this was the cause. Yahweh was here. The Ark of the Covenant was here. This is about Yahweh. It's not about us. And these are to be stones that are be a memorial forever, because the people of Israel are like us. When we remember the battles that we were in, figurative or otherwise, what was the strength that won the battle? Or what was the intelligence that won the battle? Well, I was there and I thought of this and I did. I comes up everywhere. No, this is to be about the Ark of the Covenant. You need to remember who it was that brought us here into the Promised Land. And so that's what it's going to be. And so the 12 appointed men, they did just what they were commanded to do. And it also says that Joshua, in verse 9, I turned a page and forgot I turned the page. in verse 9 it says, then Joshua set up 12 stones, where? In the middle of the Jordan. Does that mean from the middle of the Jordan? I don't think so, because we're going to see Joshua setting up stones later. When I read this, it tells me that Joshua also went to the place where the priests were standing and set 12 stones up there. And by the way, when the river came back, they're still there. Okay? And so the priests come out after they get the stones out and all the people had come in. And they hurried across, it said. I'm telling you, if you were crossing and here you are, you're walking on dry, firm ground where there had been a river flowing a minute ago or an hour ago or 2 hours ago, wouldn't you be ready to hurry? How long is this going to last? I don't know, but I'm going to get through this. We're going to be on the other side whenever it's over. And when they finished crossing, then these things were there. I'm going to probably go ahead and read some more. Verse 12, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh crossed over in battle array before the sons of Israel, just as Moses had spoken to them. About 40,000 equipped for war crossed for battle before the Lord to the desert plains of Jericho. On that day, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, so they revered him just as they had revered Moses all the days of his life. Now the Lord said to Joshua, command the priests who carry the Ark of the Testimony that they come up from the Jordan. So he commanded it, and the priests were saying, come up from the Jordan. It came about when the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord had come up from the middle of the Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet were lifted up onto dry ground, that the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and went all over its banks just as before. So these things come to be that when they're all across, we see also it mentioned that Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh came, brought 40,000 men, brought them in battle dress. They're equipped for the war. And it's seen by all of Israel. So they see that promise kept in accordance with the instructions given by Moses. That was the agreement. And so they move on to the plains of Jericho. And then in summary, we get this statement. This day, Joshua was exalted in the eyes of Israel by God's actions. They revered him like Moses in all of his days. You can imagine what God is doing for Joshua as they move forward and God gives him commands and they are going to go into battle. They're going to do various things. They are seeing that Joshua is being led just like Moses was. And when he gets word from Moses to do A, B, and C, we better do A, B, and C. So he's told to tell the priests to come up out of the Jordan. And when he did, the priests came out with the ark. And when their soles of their feet hit dry ground, the waters of the Jordan returned to normal, which was flood stage. Now there's something I want you to think about with me. We're seeing this through the eyes of Israel. Let's see this through the eyes of the people who are living in the land for a moment. There is 15 miles between where they were to the north that went to dry ground almost instantly, or maybe instantly. And we don't know, there are a few miles above the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea, and that's where the waters would go to. Maybe that whole patch in there was dry. So you're out there fishing in the Jordan. I assume that would be an activity. Of course, it was flooded, so maybe it wouldn't be such good fishing. Can you imagine when the water went away? Particularly if you were about, say, a quarter of a mile south of Adam. The water went away. Hey, Dad, look up there. It's all piled up there. I think we should leave. You know, how much thinking are you going to have to do to go, I don't want to be here when this thing goes back where it was or whatever's going to happen. This is not a safe thing to be a part of. Can you imagine what it was like for the countryside around the Jordan? Is this going to be a fairly populated area? Why? Beautiful land. What else? Somebody said it. Yeah, I mean, when you look at where settlements occur, it happens around the rivers. Why?
Water.
I mean, where are you going to do? You don't want to drill a well everywhere you stop. You know, it's interesting if you read the history of this nation. The Indians didn't they settled around rivers, but not as much. They knew which rivers flooded, and they looked at the white men and went, "That's a dumb place to build a house." I'm living further up beyond above the floodplain, and we're still trying to figure out the floodplain. When we sold our farm this last couple of years ago, I mean, we're a long, 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 long ways away from the Kansas River. And if the Kansas River ever flooded where we're at, I don't know what you're going to do. The town of Walmego's gone. The town of whatever's gone. But for whatever reason, one of our buildings was in the floodplain. Anyway, they saw something that is going to add to all of the talk and lore that has caused these people to be afraid of the Israelites. Something just happened. The town of Jericho knows the spies were here. Do you think that stayed quiet? They couldn't even get to Rahab's house without it being known. And so the people of the land are seeing a miracle of God, some at least a few, and you know they're going to talk about it. You know what I saw yesterday? Of course, they may not tell about it. You know why? They ain't going to believe me. I mean, I'm sure they told about it, but can you imagine? You saw what? You saw water piling up at Adam, making a big heap? No. And the next day, everything's back to normal? So God made a very noisy entrance, I think, bringing his people across the Jordan into the promised land to get ready for their first conquest at Jericho. Questions, comments, thoughts?
Great. Do we know that the people inside the walls of Jericho have a similar relationship with the River Jordan that the Egyptians had with the Nile in terms of worshiping it?
If they do, I don't know it.
You know, because God defeated that as a means.
Yeah, I have never heard that, and I haven't gone looking for their relationship to the Jordan. But the bulk of Canaan, I'm going to say this and say, you can check me out on this and see how right I am because I haven't thoroughly looked into this either. But as I studied the Old Testament, this and in previous times, the bulk of Canaan were Baal worshippers. Now, Baal is a name applied to lots of different kinds of gods, kind of all in the same category that is it's a Satan worship. I mean, there's just no way around it. And so I think they were focused more on Baal than they probably were on anything like the Egyptians were very much worshipers of frogs and rivers and everything, yeah. But I can't say I know that for sure. Good question. Anybody else? All right, thank you. We'll start in with verse 19 next time.